digitally uploaded.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. I'm Matthew Sensory. I'm the editor-in-chief of digitallydownloaded.net. And with me this week, we have Alan.
Hey, guys.
So we're going to have a bit of a thematic issue or episode this week. We're going to be talking about the JRPG genre in particular, and I guess looking back at some of the classics of the genre. So we will jump to some music, come back, and talk about level ups. That was a track from Shantae, because Shantae is great and we would all love to see that as a JRPG. We keep saying that, so maybe one day someone will listen. All right, so let's talk about JRPGs. We haven't had too much by way of news this week, so we'll probably skip that segment. But I did want to, it's on topic, I did want to briefly mention that Fire Emblem Fates has finally been released in Europe and Australia. And I have been playing it. I'm about 2 hours in at the moment since getting my copy yesterday. And it's good. It's great. It's actually really, really impressive stuff, actually, so far. So it's very typical kind of Fire Emblem stuff that you might expect. You've got a bunch of characters and they are battling each other out in a turn-based fashion. It's quite difficult. I've already managed to lose a couple of characters in the first couple of levels, and naturally done the thing where you restart and go through the painful process of the early stages of the level again to try and save them the next time around. Mm-hmm. But it's a remarkably attractive game on the 3DS. I thought Fire Emblem Awakening, which was the previous Fire Emblem 3DS release, was quite good looking, but this one takes things up to an entirely different level. It's quite cinematic and quite beautiful, actually. It's probably, in terms of the art aesthetic, it's probably the most attractive 3DS game that's out there at the moment. And yeah, obviously I can't talk too much about the way that they've split the narrative across a couple of different releases or versions of the game, Pokemon style. I've only really kind of got a taste for that, the setup at this stage. So if you're not aware of how it works, it seems that you'll have a choice between two different factions if you happen to have both versions of the game. Otherwise, you'll be stuck with one. But yeah, you kind of pick which side you want to fight for, and then that changes the units that you have access to and the way some of the narrative points play out. So, yes, I'll be doing a more thorough write-up of it when I've had more experience with it. But, yeah, early impressions are quite good.
I feel like pretty much any Fire Emblem game is pretty safe in terms of gameplay, because it's, like, always solid. They've sort of created a near sort of perfect little tactical RPG, even with like the first one, which I believe was on the NES, was it? Because then they ported it to GBA and that's how I played it.
Those are actually different games.
They're different games.
Oh. Yeah. So the long and convoluted history of Fire Emblem. The original one was, yes, it was an NES release, and that was the one that has Marth in it, and everyone knows Marth because of Smash Brothers. But that was a Japan-only release, and then there were a number of sequels released on the NES and then Super NES, which were also Japan exclusives. The Game Boy Advance one, which was the first one that we got in English, is something like the fifth or sixth game, I want to say, of the series. And because it was a new franchise in the West, they decided to call it just Fire Emblem here, which is confusing. Like Square Enix managed to confuse everyone, or Square back in the day managed to confuse everyone by naming the Japanese Final Fantasies differently to the Western Final Fantasies. But yeah, the one you played was the fifth or sixth one. The original NES one did eventually get a release in the West. They remade it for the DS, which is Fire Emblem Shadow something, Shadow Dragon.
I remember that. Yeah.
That is the remake of the NES one. So you can kind of play it, but yeah, different game to the GBA one.
Yeah. I'm always a fan of the sort of tactical RPG stuff, and even though I didn't really get it as a kid, I will go back and sort of play it and be like, this has actually got a lot going on. This is pretty interesting. And it sort of built my love up for XCOM, so that's why I sort of hold it in a special place in my heart.
Yeah, I mean, they have got a pretty safe formula down now, because it's, you know, they stick to it because it works. It makes for, you know, really compelling kind of gameplay. And it's challenging. They absolutely understand how to make these games challenging, which is important for the genre. Yeah, I wouldn't actually want Fire Emblem to really change. I'm happy as long as they can continue keeping the stories and the narrative and the characters fresh, which they seem to have done with this one as well. I'm already in love with a couple of characters. And, you know, they introduce kind of tiny little bits and pieces. Like, for instance, this one, there's a butler class, which is really cool. He's like this guy who can heal characters, but he also carries daggers around and kind of stabs enemies as well, which is, he's all kinds of cool. So I really like that. And I think that's a new character class for the Fire Emblem series. So they kind of change things up with those little bits and pieces, but the core gameplay, they don't change, and I don't think they should. They should stick to what they do so well.
There aren't enough tactical RPGs for like Fire Emblem to change too dramatically, because it will leave a huge hole in the entire sort of genre.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there are so many different other tactical RPGs out there. From XCOM, as you mentioned, the Final Fantasy Tactics style of tactical RPG. We don't really kind of need more of that, or for Fire Emblem to become more of that. We just need to continue to do what it does so well. Perhaps release a new one on console. That would be cool, like home console.
And actually like market it so that people know that it exists, because I don't remember anything about Radiant Dawn or Path of Radiance, Radiant Dawn was the Wii one, wasn't it? Or was it at the GameCube one?
Yeah, Path of Radiance was the GameCube one, Radiant Dawn.
Was the Wii one. I remember seeing that in a store, and it was $120 for the standard box release of like Radiant Dawn, like when it came out, because no one had a copy. And being in sort of Adelaide and being a bit quiet down there with video games sometimes, it was a bit hard to find a copy. And it was one of those things that I would see it in a magazine and be like, whoa, this looks radical, because apparently I'm a 90s. And yeah, I just never found it, and I really want them. Now that they've seen the success that it can have in a Western market, they will definitely be considering at least an NX game for the entire series, which I think would be pretty safe as a, you know, investment for them.
Yeah, you'd hope so. I mean, they've also got the mobile Fire Emblem coming, which will be apparently free to play, and I'm assuming it will have, you know, some changes. That's been said, the Fire Emblem style gameplay actually really works on the mobile as free to play. I'm playing through one that was released this week, which made waves in Japan and has finally been released in English on iOS and Android, called Phantom of the Kill, which is really, really cool. It's very similar in style to Fire Emblem, with some free-to-play kind of trappings. So, you know, the leveling up system's more like a free-to-play RPG. But yeah, it really works. So after playing that, I'm pretty confident that Nintendo can do something impressive with Fire Emblem on mobile. The only concern I have, I guess, is whether the narrative would hold up, simply because mobile games always try to be, you know, endless in terms of the content, because they want to keep people playing. So it becomes hard to have a finite or dramatic narrative under those circumstances. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that plays out, how Nintendo manages to go about taking that franchise and putting a different monetization model on it.
Yeah, definitely.
Welcome back. That was a track from Mega Dimension Neptunia VII. Well worth playing if you like JRPGs. And yeah, we do like JRPGs here. Right, so let's talk about classic JRPGs. We thought it'd be interesting this week to kind of look back at, I guess, the games that got us into the genre way back when, especially since Alan and I are both Australians, and for the longest time, the JRPG genre was really undercooked in this country. A lot of games that were even released in America never actually came out here or did in such limited supply that they were almost impossible to find. So a lot of the classics are kind of games that Australians, or at least I know I have, kind of discovered after the fact. So it's good in one way. It means I get to keep discovering these classic JRPGs and playing them for the first time now, as I am with Wild Arms 3, which is just released on the PS4. Which is good, by the way, from the very short time I've played it so far. But yeah, it's an interesting process that a lot of Australians have come to the JRPG genre. So, I mean, Alan, how did you kind of discover the JRPGs? What was your first, I guess, game in that genre, whenabouts, and how did you find it?
So back in 2001, the Christmas of 2000 and entering into 2001, the PS2 had just released in Australia. And I was lucky enough to receive a joint gift with my two sisters and I getting a PS2. And it came with a demo disc on it that had the trailer for Final Fantasy X. And that was my first introduction to JRPGs, because I would sit there and watch this amazing FMV of Tidus and the entire party like skating down this the rails into Bavel. And that was my first like whoa moment. And because they also had Metal Gear Solid on the disc, I watched that disc like 4 or 5 times. And that was my first real introduction. And I saw the name and I was like, whoa, Final Fantasy X. And then a couple of years later, I was pretty heavily playing my Game Boy because, you know, I was 7 or something at the time. And I managed to stumble sort of across a copy of Final Fantasy IV on the Game Boy. And I was trading in some games. I was like, yeah, no, I want to try this. This looks rad. So FF4 became the first real JRPG for me, I feel. And I loved it. I loved every bit. I loved the story, which was something I really wasn't used to, because most of the games at the time, like I was playing Rayman, I was playing like Jak and Daxter, which isn't really heavily narrative focused, whereas like a JRPG like Final Fantasy IV is very heavily narrative focused. And because I loved reading at the time, it sort of worked out quite well for me. A lot of new words, actually. like Fira, Viraga, you know, use them all in daily sort of conversations. so that was definitely my sort of first introduction into JRPGs, and I still love Final Fantasy IV a lot. I do think that the GBA port's the best port, because I really dislike the art style of the DS one. The 3D is just it's like a worse quality Bravely Default, and I very much don't like that. The original sprite work is really, really good, so if you can get a copy of that, I would recommend it. Similarly, I think the PS1 classic edition on the PS3 at the moment is the sprite work mixed with some CG, but I'm not sure, so don't quote me on that one. But yeah, Final Fantasy IV is great. I love the characters. I love everyone's names except for Cecil, because who names their character Cecil? That was my first real introduction, and then sort of blossomed from there, and I bought Final Fantasy X in like 2004 or something, and then went from there and just kept buying all these games, and then bought 12 and was very confused and didn't enjoy myself. Continuing the trend of me bashing on 12.
Yeah, I mean, my introduction to the JRPG genre also came via Final Fantasy, though a little bit earlier on than you, I guess. So I had the original, the Game Boy, and I used to play a lot of, you know, Tetris and Mario and all of the good platformers that console had, the original one. And then at one stage, I mean, I didn't know much about the JRPG genre, but I was a big fan of the tabletop Dungeons & Dragons. I had all the books and was really involved in the whole fantasy stuff. Loved Lord of the Rings, loved Ramity Feist, read a lot of fantasy books. So one day I was at the game shop and there was Final Fantasy Legends 2, I believe it was. And it kind of, you know, intrigued me because it was, it had a fantasy style box art and all that kind of stuff. Didn't know what Final Fantasy was, but yeah, it seemed interesting. So anyway, I picked that up, stuck it into the game console and kind of, yeah, that was an instant mind-blowing experience for me, as simple as that game was. You know, here I was on this epic quest and you know, I was had all these characters and, you know, all the battles were like turn-based and strategic and I was fighting these monsters and things that could have come from Dungeons & Dragons style book. And yeah, I lost a lot of time playing that game. And from there, I kind of started to, okay, so what's this Final Fantasy thing? Started to investigate the series, realized that an awful lot of it wasn't really available in Australia. Did some dodgy things as kids tend to do when they're intrigued about things like find emulators and fan translations and things, which is naughty, I know, but really there wasn't much other way to do it in Australia.
Yeah, it was either you did that or you just didn't consume the media and it was a bit unfortunate. Like it wasn't a case of you had to find a paywall. It was literally, you cannot play this in your region.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, I my first experience of Final Fantasy, the main series, not the the GB ones. Yes, not the Legends, not really Final Fantasy series, was Final Fantasy IV, like you, but it was a fan translation of the Japanese Final Fantasy IV as opposed to actual Final Fantasy II, as it was called in the West.
That still confuses me to this day.
and I, like you, I absolutely loved like every moment of it. And yeah, from that point, I really was lost on Final Fantasy. Since then, I guess, I mean, I still hold Final Fantasy very kind of precious to me. It's very, it is my JRPG foundation, but obviously I've kind of moved to being a bigger fan, I guess, of, some other series like Atelier, which is, you know, we got a new one of those coming along, which is very exciting. But yeah, I'm still always interested when a new Final Fantasy game comes, and 15 should be good.
Should be. One of the funniest things that I've encountered was when I picked up the box of Final Fantasy IV on Game Boy. It said, you know, Final Fantasy IV, and then it had like text box in the bottom was called Final Fantasy II in the West.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So I was like, wait, what? I'm very confused by this. And because then they went straight to 6 on the GBA. When I finally found a copy of that through importing, because apparently they were just like, this isn't going to be a thing in Australia. Thank you again for, you know, porting that over. Great PAL formatting. It was called Final Fantasy VI, and I was like, where is 5? What is this? I don't understand.
5 was a very forgotten game for a long time, because that was a new release originally. So yeah, Final Fantasy I was released in the West. They skipped past 2 and 3. Then Final Fantasy 4 became Final Fantasy 2 in the West. They skipped past 5. And then Final Fantasy 6 became Final Fantasy 3 in the West.
Which is still the best Final Fantasy, I think.
Yeah, personally. And since then they've been trying to fix that confusion because it still confuses some people, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, unless you sort of had someone tell you that and sort of lay it out in a timeline, you'd be very confused.
Yeah. Yeah, it was weird that Square didn't localize all the games. I guess they didn't have the same resources they do now. But
well, I guess even after the success of FF1, like you'd think they would be churning them out.
Well, they did in Japan.
Yeah, in the West as well, because it was a huge success in the West. It was ridiculous. I remember like, even though I was not even born at the time, I remember reading like magazines in sort of the late 90s, early 2000s, being like, whoa, this game had a pretty big impact, because it was all just these people going like, yeah, no, Final Fantasy is like revolutionary. And I would just imagine that Square would have put them all out on every possible area, which they have now, because I think you can get a couple of the old games on like iPhone, I believe.
Oh, no, they're all available now. So, like, Final Fantasy 2 and 3 were released everywhere. Final Fantasy 2 is available on PSP, iPhone, the Game Boy Advance via
Dawn of Souls. Yeah. That game was really
so
cool.
On and so forth. Final Fantasy III was released for the first time in the West on the DS with that art style that you're not a big fan of, the 3D remake art style. That's the only version of that game that's actually available in English, but that's also made its way to PSP/Vita and iOS and Android. So that one's out there. And so the only Final Fantasy game you can't get available on modern platforms somewhere, the only two, is Final Fantasy XI, which is the MMO, and then Final Fantasy XII, which they've just never got around to remaking or HD remastering.
And it should stay that way.
Which those of us who are fans of the game will kind of hope comes after Final Fantasy XV before the remake of VII. I think that's the timeline that kind of makes sense to remake that game, if that makes sense.
I would much prefer to have a Final Fantasy VI full remaster, remake, you know, like give the full treatment, because that game is so much better than VII and no one agrees with me and I get very annoyed.
That's not going to happen, I don't think. I think VI is just going to be left as it is. I suspect the 3D graphic remaster of Final Fantasy 3 and 4 didn't set the world on fire like Square wanted, so it's probably, you know, to do that to any other game in the series has probably been put down the priority list.
Yeah, probably. And, you know, I'd like to see a return to the more Final Fantasy 9 style game one day, but I doubt that'll ever happen, unfortunately. Because I've been taking a look at Final Fantasy 9 again, actually, and that game still holds up. It's really good. It's more like it's a sequel to 4 and 6 more than anything else. And I really love that because, I don't know, I did not enjoy the materia system in 7. And I never understood junctioning. Still don't understand junctioning. It's baffling and insane to me. And I know it's probably very simple and there are people yelling at me right now, but, you know, I still don't get it. And, you know, 9's a little brought it back to a more cohesive, like, you're wearing armor, this is the bonuses, this is the negatives. And yeah, I want that sort of game again. And I think FFX did that really well as well with the armor system with Riku's customization and stuff like that. And I don't know enough about 12 to give any sort of critique on that. So,
well, I mean, you've got, I think you're right. I don't think Square is going to go back to doing that kind of game with the main Final Fantasy series anymore. They're too, it's just too big. They can't afford to take risks in having a game that's kind of appeal to a niche audience. But that's about as far as it goes. So I think in terms of, you know, Final Fantasy, the mainline series, you're going to just keep getting stuff like Final Fantasy 15, which, you know, kind of ups the action perception, probably has the sci-fi elements because that goes well in Japan. That's popular. But, you know, Square's managed the Final Fantasy series better than the franchise, better than I think most people give them credit for. They've got World of Final Fantasy coming, and World of Final Fantasy looks like the most adorably cute throwback to traditional Final Fantasy values that you'll ever see. It's just, you know, go and have a look at screenshots if you haven't seen it already. It's just adorable. And it will appeal to Final Fantasy, you know, kind of veterans. They've got, you know, the Chocobo Final Fantasy Fable series, which is really needs a new game now. The last one was on the Wii, but it was also, you know, a very traditional style Final Fantasy game with very traditional Final Fantasy values woven through it. So, you know, in terms of management of the franchise, Square's kind of throwing the fans these kind of sub-games. And meanwhile, it's developing the Final Fantasy, you know, mainline series in the kind of blockbuster AAA way that it needs to be developed. So, yeah, I at least give Square Enix the thumbs up for the way they manage that series.
Well, I mean, when you compare it to how other franchises have been run by companies like, I don't know, Capcom, Resident Evil, yeah, that's a... still holds up as a good series, I guess. Have you seen that they're trying to resell Final Fantasy VI, Resident Evil 6 on PS4 now? And I don't know who's buying that, and I don't know why you'd buy that, because there are much better ways to spend $30, like buying Final Fantasy, Resident Evil 4, because I'm pretty sure that's on every single console in the world, including the Game Boy printer.
Yeah, I'm just, I don't get the Resident Evil series. We had that discussion.
They are trying.
Yeah, well, in theory, kind of, see, now you've got me doing it. In theory, Resident Evil 7 is meant to be a throwback to the horror, the classic horror genre. from what we've seen and read, and I don't believe that for a second, to be honest.
Yeah, I was reading that and just slowly facepalming and collapsing on my desk, crying.
At best, they might take something and make it look like Resident Evil 4, and then try and, you know, throw some more jump scares in there rather than turn down the action a little bit. I don't know. To me, Resident Evil should be, you know, tank controls and slow stuff, and then, you know, it should be clunky and unwieldy, and that's where a lot of the horror comes from. And that doesn't sit with, you know, making a blockbuster Resident Evil game. So don't know really what Capcom can actually do to resolve that, but they've dug the series into a hole, and I don't think they can dig it back out again.
Also, Marvel vs. Capcom as well. I just want that to come back. More than anything else. And like every single Square franchise has at least been mildly strong, and that really confuses me when you have like other like publishers just running their franchises into the ground when they're so popular. It's
Well, Square Enix does such a good job with a lot of their franchises, like you say. I mean, let's take if you take Star Ocean for an example, like that's a very B grade JRPG series by Square standards. You know, that doesn't sell so well. It's not, you know, the massive property that Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest are, but they've managed that series very well. It's got a very dedicated fan base. When I was at TGS last year, the lines for that game were as long as anything in there, with the exception of Monster Hunter, because Monster Hunter being Monster Hunter. The Japanese just line up for days to play that. But, you know, coming second to Monster Hunter in terms of raw lineup, having like 180 minute wait to play the game on the least busy day of the event, you know, That's a well-managed series franchise. Star Ocean 5, when it comes out later, I think it's June, so only a couple of weeks now. It probably won't sell huge in the West, but hopefully it does well enough, because the last two Star Oceans, which are the only two I've played, unfortunately, I missed the first two, but Star Ocean 3 and 4 are actually really good little games and often forgotten, because it's, you know, not the AAA Square Enix experience.
I believe that was it. Star Ocean to the End of Time.
The PS2
one. That was the PS2 one, because I remember playing that, and I remember that was really, really cool. Yeah, no, I remember this game. Yep. Okay, cool. I'm not going insane.
Intimidating as heck, that game, because Final Fantasy X, so I just finished up with Final Fantasy X, and I was absolutely blown away with it and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I came across this like Star Ocean game by Square Enix, and I was like, oh my god, it's a Square Enix RPG, I have to play it. Remembering that, you know, JRPGs weren't so huge in Australia at that point in time, so, you know, information about these games was relatively limited. I was just going on the fact it was a Square Enix RPG. But then I opened it up and it was like two discs. Two PS2 discs. I was like, holy crap, how big can this game possibly be if they can fit Final Fantasy X on one, and this is like two disc game. So yeah, it was intimidating to get into, because like, do I have 3 months to play just one game? And yeah, I'm glad I did, because it was good. It was a very big game, but it was good.
Yeah, because I remember renting it, and as you probably not like realize, it's not at all reasonable to complete a JRPG in the space of a week of a rent.
Especially that one.
Yeah, especially when you realize that it's two discs and it's huge and it's very, very confusing and will take a lot of time to understand. And I remember seeing that and being like, oh, I'm probably not going to touch this again, because it was just such a huge time commitment. And because I was playing 10 still religiously, which is quite ironic given the subject matter of the game. I just didn't have the time for it, quite frankly. Still like 10 more. I will defend 10. I want to play 10 too, though. I've never played 10-2.
10-2 is great. Very underrated, I think. It's very different, and I think people got put off by it being different. It's very light in tone when compared to 10, and it's got a lot of fan service-y elements in it, but... you know, it's good. It's a precursor to what we saw in Final Fantasy 13 in terms of the combat system as well. It's quite dynamic. It's quite interesting. So, yeah, I think it deserves a look. And I think with the re-release of the game...
it's getting a bit of a resurgence. Like, I'm noticing there's a lot of people talking about it, especially with the PC release as well.
Yeah, like I think people are rediscovering it, and I think people are kind of rethinking what they thought about it because, yeah, they don't have the expectation anymore that it's going to be like Final Fantasy X. So putting that expectation aside, they're judging it more on its own merits, and I think it's kind of shaping up better than they remember.
Yeah, definitely.
Mega Dimension Neptunia VII, but we should use that a bit because we're talking about JRPGs this week. So with our discussion for how we got into JRPGs done, I thought for the last segment it might be a cool idea to talk about, I guess, the impact that the JRPG genre has had on other genres out there, because it has had a very significant impact on just about everything from, you know, puzzle games through to shooters and so on. Yeah, I don't think the genre gets all the credit it deserves at times for being such an influential one. Let's start with Alan talking about the racing game and how the JRPG genre has had an impact on that.
So when we got the PS2 as well, there was, you know, a couple of games that we could have bought at the time. And one of those was Gran Turismo 3. And that was my first real introduction to the racing game genre. And what was really interesting about this game is that I had no idea, but it was really more of a JRPG than you give it credit. It's the car RPG, as I think it's colloquially termed. It's got the exact same sort of structure in that you start out quite weak with a, you know, weakish car. Nothing too great, like a 1987, like Honda Civic or something. I don't know, something garbage. And then, you know, you enter races, which are sort of substitution for random battles. If you win them, you get money, which you can use to upgrade your car or then buy new cars and sort of keep going up in this progression level. And I think that's pretty much the exact same structure as with JRPG. And they knew that because it's very, very addicting. And it got to the point where with Gran Turismo 4, I completed one of the 24-hour races to unlock the, I think it was like a Chaparral or something. Which was huge for the time, like for me. it created a very, very interesting thing where it was very addicting and very easy to get lost in this world of I'm going to keep collecting cars, which it's the same thing as collecting like equipment or like weapons or anything in any other JRPG, but it's just you're collecting like Nissan GTRs and cool stuff. And yeah, I think the impact that it's had simply on just racing games and creating this very easily approachable progression system really, really is important to sort of sit back and, you know, sort of appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the JRPG genre, I find it always interesting that, you know, for me anyway, the draw to the genre has always been the narratives and the storytelling and so on and so forth. But in terms of the influence that the genre has had, it's always been on taking that very basic core gameplay loop that it has, which is, you know, you do an action, you get a tangible reward for it, or an intangible reward, you know, those experience bars and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, for every you know, you're making constant micro progress. So you know, every battle, you get something out of it. Every couple of steps, every couple of moments, there's always, you know, there's this continuous feedback loop, and it's very simple. It's very short. It's very, you break it down to its components, and it's this very, very basic way of charting progress through a game. And that's become, I guess, the core influencing factor that the JRPG genre has had. And nowadays you have these progress bars on everything. You know, every single game has some kind of progress bar attached to it. Every mobile game has these progress bars attached to them. And yeah, that comes from the JRPG genre. That wasn't part of the platforming genre back when, you know, Mario was bopping around. That wasn't part of, you know, so many other, you know, the strategy genre at the time didn't have any of that kind of nonsense. It was, it was just single battles, and then units would kind of disappear after the battle and they'd come back for the next battle, but they wouldn't have any progress attached to them. So all that progress side of things was really came from the JRPG genre.
Yeah, and the most influential game of the last generation, Modern Warfare, that sort of really did that. And it did it so well that it became this huge mega hit. And I think as far as introduction of RPG elements into games, it's the best way to create player investment because you become attached to the character. Even if it's not a narrative thing, you still become attached to what your character is doing because you are doing it. And then seeing that your progress bar, whether it's going up, you're not only increasing in your own personal skill as it's an action game, but you're also increasing within progress in the context of the game world. So you're moving at the same speed with your character, which is very, very important and creates this investment within the game.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of agency, I guess, in terms of that feedback loop, because it is a feedback loop that's as a result of your actions as opposed to a result of, you know, other factors within the game space. So, yeah, I with the way the shooter genre goes, obviously I'm not the world's expert on shooters, but... you know, you see it becoming more and more impactful in the genre. So you know, Destiny is a good example, I guess, of, you know, a game that really goes out of its way to push those progress feedback loops in terms of both the experience bars and then also the actual loot. When you break it down, Destiny, everything scales as you do from what I remember of Destiny.
Yep, so, man, it's bland.
Yeah, so as a result, I mean, it's... The actual progress is more perception than anything else, because you know, you do 10 damage more, the enemies can take 10 more damage. You know, so all those numbers and all that pop up as you're shooting enemies is a very artificial kind of thing. But it is, you still feel like you're making progress because, you know, once you were doing 15 damage to the enemy or whatever, now you're doing 25 with every shot. So yeah, you feel like you're making progress. And I think Bungie's quite clever in terms of making that very addictive, even though
it's bland.
In terms of the actual impact that it's having on the game, it's very minimal. So yeah, that was interesting for me.
I think something else to really sort of bring into the fold there is the greater MMO genre. Everything that's been MMOified. So even Tom Clancy's The Division, the biggest IP launch, a new IP launch, I believe it was, sold a huge amount. And that game is basically just an MMO with heavy JRPG elements. It's very similar to Destiny, but I think it's a little bit less egregiously bland and with a lot less Paul McCartney theme song as well. I think that people have sort of woken up to the idea that JRPGs can be a very, very rewarding genre when you put enough time into them. And because you have these, you know, games that people expect to be playing for, you know, 10, 20 hours, adding in elements like just basic sort of damage upgrades or, you know, like minor stat boosts, even like a buff or something, people will get excited about. So it really creates like full on, I don't want to say addiction quality because that sounds really negative, but like very, very heavy player investment. And you know, it keeps these games going. And Borderlands as well is a game that's built entirely around this idea of progression, building yourself up, that sort of thing. And I think that's as one of the biggest hits of the last generation. It's very, very easy to see how much something like, you know, Final Fantasy 1 influences everything, and how Dragon Quest influences everything that's modern. And I think it's something that people don't really take into consideration enough, and it should really be, you know, sort of lauded as the sort of mechanic of the generation, at least the late generation.
I mean, the even more extreme example, I guess, is if you look at the MOBA genre, what makes the MOBA genre so popular, and I'm talking about, you know, League of Legends, Smite, and so on with this, is that every single match resets the progression curve. So you start every single match at level one, your character does, and then by the end of it, you raise them up to level 20 or whatever. And as they go through, they get more powerful. They get they get cash, which they use to buy loot, you know, better equipment, and they get skills as they level up and so on. And then at the end of the match, everything's reset back down to one. So you have this constant
sense of improvement.
Well, every single match you do this exact same process over and over again, but it's addictive because, again, you just constantly, where, for instance, a JRPG or Modern Warfare or whatever, there is an eventual, or Destiny, there's an eventual cap where you can't actually improve your character any further. With this one, you're basically constantly doing that over and over again. So there's an endless quality to it as well. And I think that's why people can end up spending an awful lot of time playing those games, beyond the fact that, you know, it's fun because it's competitive and there's a lot of money involved if you want to get really serious about it. I think that distilling that loop down into half an hour segments is quite clever from the people that created that genre at Riot and whatever. I did want to mention, in terms of where the RPG, not necessarily the JRPG genre in this case, but the RPG genre as a whole, as a storytelling experience, has been able to be recreated in a game particularly well. There was a Xbox and PC game called Call of Cthulhu, Dark Corners of the Earth, which is a horror game. And it was based heavily on, well, firstly, Lovecraft's stories, but also the Call of Cthulhu actual pen and paper RPG. And what I found so interesting about that one was it did away with the stats and all of that kind of stuff, as the pen and paper RPG tries to do. This is a game that's more about telling a story and, you know, engaging with the narrative and so on. So for me, that game was so fascinating because it's not stat-based at all. There's very little combat because everything's basically able to kill you. So it's a very stealth-orientated game as well. And what made that game so interesting was the way it managed to tell an RPG-like story without the RPG elements that we typically expect in games. So a lot of people didn't really recognize it as an RPG, but if you ever played the Call of Cthulhu pen and paper game, it's readily and very quickly apparent that it is an actual RPG as you're playing it.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
All right, so I think that pretty much covers off our chat about RPGs, JRPGs, and all things good like that this week. Thank you very much, as always, for listening. You can catch us on our social medias, which will be on the podcast description. Otherwise, we look forward to catching you next week. Thanks very much for your time.
Catch you guys.
Digitally uploaded.